Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Andy Davis. Venturi's Voice brings together thought leaders from a variety of industries who are taking the most innovative approaches to leadership and staffing. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors sharing their secrets on leadership, recruiting, onboarding, engagement, and motivating, as well as stories on life lessons they've learned along the way. And it's free. If you're the head of a major corporation leading a team of hundreds or about to take on your first leadership role, this podcast is for you. This show is about you, and we're here to help you become the best leader you can be. Stay up to date with the latest shows by subscribing on iTunes and SoundCloud, as well as signing up to the newsletter at venturi-group.com, where you can find the latest IT jobs, talent, and blogs on all things leadership, staffing, and development. I'd love to hear from you, so drop me a line anytime via email at andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback or requests are always welcome. Enjoy the show. Today's guest is Ian Bourne from the Information Commissioner's Office, here to talk with us about GDPR. Well, thank you for joining us today. Ian from the ICO.
Yep.
So what is the ICO and what do you do?
Okay, we're the Information Commissioner's Office and we're based up here in Winslow, just like Venturi.
Yeah.
And we do data protection law, which is about giving people rights over their personal information and setting standards for information handling for organisations. And we also do freedom of information law, which is about giving people access to official information. So those are the two main things we do. We also enforce rules to do with electronic marketing. But we do a range of things. We do complaint handling from the public. We do policy type work, we do engagement type work, and of course we do enforcement. Mm-hmm. We can fine organisations if they break the rules. That's what we do pretty much.
And obviously I think we've kind of got you in here, and just from, mainly from our cyber team, there's a lot going on around the GDPR regulation that we seem to be hearing. So we're obviously here to talk a lot about that, and I just wanted to like start off by something that I had kind of noted as well about the GDPR was when the government are kind of implementing new regulations, new rules, it tends to be kind of everywhere in the press. I consider myself like to be pretty informed and stay up to date with like the latest press. The GDPR, maybe it's too early for it to be getting the publicity that it deserves, but I didn't seem to see like a ton of press out there about it yet. Do you think that it's maybe a bit too early? Why do you think that is?
I think it's because data protection, the GDPR, is seen as a very kind of geeky, specialist, technical kind of thing, which doesn't really affect most businesses. But in fact, it does, because everybody, even the smallest little factory or the smallest office, keeps records, you know, personal information about their employees, their clients and so forth. Mm. So it does actually affect everyone, but I think it's seen as this very niche thing which isn't really relevant in the mainstream, but I think that's wrong. Mm. And for our own part of the ICO, we try to do, you know, a reasonable amount of publicity without bombarding people with stuff. And getting the messaging right around this has been quite difficult, because on the one hand, there's a lot of new stuff in the GDPR. There are things you'll have to do you didn't have to do before. But on the other hand, it's based around the same kind of principles and concepts, and it's still meant to do the same kinds of things. So it's a bit difficult to get the story right. On the one hand, you're saying, yeah, there is change coming, but you don't want to panic people into thinking it's year zero.
Mm.
So that's been a bit of a complicating factor. And it's not that long till it comes in. It's going to be May next year, which isn't very long, is it?
Yeah.
Especially if you're a business of any size trying to do planning around this.
Yeah.
We're working on guidance. We've already put some out already. But I do get your point that it's probably not had the publicity it ought to have had.
Yeah. Maybe it takes an example. I don't know. It tends to need something that is press-worthy or something that the press can get stuck into. Planning and safety doesn't probably get the papers particularly excited.
Well, it was in the Sun over the weekend, so you never know, do you?
No, that is a surprise, actually.
Funnily enough, one of the things that you see, and I've sort of been involved in this sort of world for a long time, is that, you know, years ago, maybe a decade ago, this was, you'd only ever get it on covered in the specialist press or the kind of the weighty sort of broadsheets, you know. now it's become much more mainstream. Data loss stories, for example, data security stories, phones getting hacked stories, they're in the papers all the time, and I think it's become a much more mainstream thing, and that's a tendency that's going to continue, I think.
So I wanted to ask as well about GDPR. I was reading up a little bit about it. I'm obviously by no means an expert, which is why we've kind of got you, obviously got you here today. Yeah. There seems to be a certain element of the GDPR that potentially could mean like the slight blurred lines there about like what is a green tick and what is a red X. Like,
yeah,
there's going to be, I think, examples of this throughout where it's like we need to police it, but then people need to put it down to their own interpretations. You know, there's so many variables and different ways that people store data. There's different technologies in which people store data. So obviously, I think that's probably half the reason why it's come across as potentially blurred lines there.
Yeah.
How is that? How difficult is that going to be, do you think? And is that something that you guys are preparing for on the policing side of it?
Yeah, we're used to it. And I think there are two sort of elements in the GDPR. There's a whole lot of stuff where it is actually quite kind of objective and clear what you have to do. Right, you have to keep this particular sort of record, or you have to give somebody access to their information this particular amount of days. So that there's a big element to it where there isn't really any sort of judgment involved. It's just things that you either have to do or don't have to do. But underneath data protection law, there's a whole lot of area for subjectivity and judgment and trying to assess what is reasonable in the circumstances. And that's really what data protection law is all about. And in terms of us at the ICO and indeed other data protection authorities across Europe, we're used to doing those judgments and we're used to saying this is reasonable, this isn't unreasonable, this is fair, this is what somebody's likely to expect and agree to when they, you know, give their information to somebody. So that side of it isn't new. And I think we get better at that. And I think the industry gets better at that. I think years ago about beacon marketing, this was when e-commerce sites teamed up with social networking sites. So when you bought something on an e-commerce site, all your social media friends were automatically alerted of what it was you bought. And this caused a bit of a stir, as you can imagine. And that's one of those cases where both we and, you know, the companies involved now would say, well, actually, don't you think we ought to ask people before we turn that feature on? So it's about reasonableness and judgment, and that's what's at the heart of data protection, about treating people properly, really. Via their information. That's how we very much approach it at the ICO. It's a kind of bit of an ethical thing, really.
There's a lot of companies that will have kind of heard about it, but will think that, as you said earlier on, that this won't affect me. You know, this is kind of going to be for the guys. I don't know whether it's a cybercrime. I think it seems to be like kind of the theme that people kind of looking at and thinking that this is GDPR regulations for people who are committing cybercrime, right? Which sounds like a hard line, but when people are looking at data, they're committing crimes without probably knowing it. So, you know, just for an example, like what is like the lower level things where, you know, you actually would be breaching regulation? If you can just give us an example, maybe even look at, you know, I don't know, like an email, like holding onto email address for the over the allotted period of time. Like, what are the kind of some of the lower level crimes that people were committing that they might think this isn't going to affect me, but actually you are committing the crimes.
A lot. There aren't actually that many, actually, technically speaking, that many criminal offences in data protection. It's mainly breaches of principle.
Right.
So there are some kind of breaches that obviously aren't as bad as other ones. And we reflect that in our enforcement strategy. So that we want to go for the bad guys and the people who really cause trouble. So there are things like, I mean, data protection has got things like rules on the retention of employee records, for example. But, you know, it's always a bit of a how long is the length of string type situation, in terms of how long you actually do keep an employee record after they've left your employer, for example. So there are cases where that could, you know, employers could hang on to records a bit longer than they ought to, and that technically would be a breach. But if it has no consequences for the individual and the records are kept safe, they're not used for, you know, different or unusual purposes inappropriately, then it's unlikely we'd act on that. But also you get a whole load of people at the hard end of this. You do get cyber criminals, and the interplay between data protection and other law around cyber crime is complicated.
Mm.
But for our own part, you do get, for example, people who sell really bad quality marketing lists, and people who ring people up and send them emails and stuff when they don't want them, when they've not agreed to that. So there are people who deliberately make money out of breaking the law. So they're the people we tend to go for in terms of enforcement. And this is an industry that it's difficult to police. They, you know, you shut one company down, another one comes into being the next day. But we're thinking we're kind of isolating these people and befriending, as it were, the sort of legitimate marketing industry. That's a big thing for us, the marketing rules. But those are the kind of things we go for. We also go for things like, you know, deliberately lax or bad data breaches when people just don't update their security or they don't put the patches on, and you end up with, you know, people's hospital records or whatever it is ending up on the internet.
Mm.
And these things happen. So those kind of serious things are the ones we go for. But we recognise that there's a whole lot of inconsequential, relatively trivial breaches that have no real effect on people. And we deal with that through guidance. We might do an advisory audit, which you can ask us to do if you want. And so we'll sort of take you through the processes of what you ought to be doing. So hopefully that'll be mended in the future. But we have a real range of responses to various types of incident.
So interesting about the marketing, like regulations and working with that. I can only imagine on like the nuances involved in that. There's so many different platforms out there that, you know, their kind of revenue stream comes from marketing. And obviously it's about targeting these days. That's what these sites have brought to the table. It's like this targeting advertisements, you know. I'm familiar myself with Google AdWords, Facebook ads, you know, all these kind of, and you're kind of, but you're using those platforms for the simple reason that they're targeted, right? So what other kind of regulations, and you know, you alluded to the fact about the poor marketing where these really rubbish emails. I get emails from those kind of people, like asking, do I want to buy a, I can't remember, like normally like Jet 2's mailing list or something like that, you know, that they try and ask me to buy. Is it about, you know, actually, is that kind of where there's blurred lines? Because I foresee someone who's selling people's information to be like, that's a criminal activity. But if you've captured it and you're marketing material out to them, is that still considered in the same context?
No, it depends on how you get the information. If you're a member of the public or a consumer and you're dealing with a particular organisation and they give you proper choices and a proper consent mechanism for what they can do with your information, like can they sell it on to third parties or not, then fine. The problem we get is when those choices aren't given, and however this occurs, somebody ends up with a mailing list. They don't know what its provenance is. They don't know what the original permissions were. And then they just start marketing people who may well have been on the telephone preference service, for example. And it's illegal to ring people up if they're on the TPS, other than in very limited circumstances. So that's the basic sort of issue. But I think when you look at marketing, I think, and particularly like you were saying about behavioural advertising and online marketing, the enlightened and successful parts of the industry want to send relevant content to people who want to get it and who are interested in it.
Right.
And that is all based on fairness and permissions and consent mechanisms and choice mechanisms and privacy notices and telling you what how you're going to use their information. But you see that all the time, and the companies that prosper from this are the ones who deal with people who want to deal with them. I think that's the golden rule. You see that all the time in the marketing industry when you talk to marketers. That's the situation they're trying to get to. They want to send, you know, gardening catalogues to me because I like gardening or because I like the company who's sending them, you know, and I'm more likely to buy than if it's some random thing for something I've got no interest in, you know.
Right.
And as the technology develops, it's getting much better in terms of targeting relevant content to relevant people. And that kind of works from a data protection point of view, because all the kind of collateral privacy damage is minimised.
Right.
That suits us, you know.
Right, yeah. And obviously it's kind of a, you know, sign of the dotted line. I think there was a documentary, I think, about that, the big internet agencies, and when you update software and you're kind of knowing the terms and agreeing, it's all in there.
Yep.
When you're like agreeing to that, so they're always kind of protecting themselves.
Yep.
To that extent. And even, do you think that that's something that is that part of what you are encouraging the smaller companies to kind of start investing in, is these terms and conditions when you're doing business with them, and how heavily invested are you kind of advising smaller to medium-sized businesses to kind of go down that road?
We do a lot of guidance and advice and support of various sorts, and I think we're going to be doing more for SMEs, because especially in the digital sector, sort of the UK is so good at startup companies.
Yeah,
who have got great ideas to do clever things with information, and they need the sort of the regulatory stuff sorted out, so we can help them to do that. And the big technology companies and the big financial services and people like that, they tend to have their own compliance people and lawyers, so they can probably work most of it out themselves. Although, of course, the standards that they get to is very, very important, because we all use, you know, the big search engines every day. And you do need clear, reasonable terms and conditions, but sometimes they're a bit frightening. I was looking over the weekend, actually, I was using a big e-commerce site, and it had a new app which apparently lets you track your parcels better, and it said by activating this app you are agreeing to the following things. One of the things was we can read and alter any traffic going from your computer to or from a website, or worse to that effect. And I thought that was astounding. I thought, no way am I agreeing to that. It's like horrifying.
Yeah.
So you've got to read things, and I think there's a big, I mean, consumers are never going to sit there reading privacy notices, but things like that, it was actually quite good in terms of being very clear and legible and prominent.
Yeah.
But the content was kind of frightening, and I think, you know, when you hear the tech coast talking about the creepy line and having to keep away from the creepy line, sometimes you do see the creepy line, and I think consumers, they're getting more sensitive to that sort of thing. I think in the future, you'll get more kind of civil society, consumer protection type activity around this. A bit like you do in like Holland now, for example, where there's a really strong kind of digital consumer protection movement. I'm going to see more of that in the UK.
It's interesting as well, you talk about, you know, content and relevant content and selling them gardening equipment because you like gardening, for example, you know. Mm-hmm. But, how, you know, like you were saying, how does that content, you know, get different? I mean, we're going to get to the point where it's going to be so tailored that people are going to have, marketers are going to be able to build technology where not one person would see the same website. Yep. If I like blue, the website would be blue or whatever, you know, so on and so forth. Like, but like, see, how do you, it's got to be so difficult to police that, because how are people not taking that as like leverage and using that as kind of propaganda to, you know, I don't know, for all kinds of crazy political gains? Like, you can surely manipulate the content to you know, that extent if you really wanted to. Now, never mind, you know, in the future.
And I think people don't realise that when you've got a website, it may be very, very different from the version of the website that somebody else has seen based on your browser settings and search history, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And there's certainly a public education issue there. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. But I think it is about that creepy line and thinking, where does this get too much? And we're doing some work, well, with some academics on, it's called empathic computing, where due to your online behaviour and how you type things and the words you use, it's all based on artificial intelligence. They can tell a lot about your state of mind, whether you're in a good mood, bad mood, angry, whether you're likely to buy things, not buy things, whether you want a happy ending to a film or a sad one.
Mm.
And it all gets a bit freaky, really. And you could even go and watch Bambi or something on your computer, and the Bambi doesn't die, you know, depending on your state of mind. Different movie endings are being developed. You know, it's incredible stuff.
Yeah.
And I think how you stop that being creepy and how you stop it being to the disadvantage of people, I think, is a major challenge. But there's also sorts of great things about this as well, aren't there, I think? And it's easy to be too negative, but there's a lot of really positive and entertaining and useful things coming out of all this?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, like, say we talk a lot about data, you know, and AI and blockchain and a lot of these kind of technologies that are coming through. And there's always going to be the skeptics, you know, people are skeptical and worried that, you know, there's going to be so many robots that these like low level jobs aren't going to be necessary anymore and all this kind of thing. So I think with like you say, it's policing it, and with policing it, you know, what kind of investment is there to effectively police these new regulations that are going to be coming out in May 28th, is it?
May 28th. Well, it's difficult, and we've always, at the ICO, tried to choose our targets very carefully, because every company in the UK and every company in the world keeps personal information to some extent.
Mm.
It might not be terribly exciting what they do with it. It might be very low risk, fine. But the idea that we can actually meaningfully monitor or check every business that keeps personal information is pie in the sky. We're never going to do that.
Yeah.
But we can educate, we can issue guidance, we can target our resources on areas of genuine risk, people who collect a lot of sensitive information about a lot of people, for example. Government is very, very important here in terms of what they do with citizens' information. So we can do that. We can listen to what the public say, and we're a lot better. We've got something called an intelligence hub, so we sort of monitor complaints about particular organisations and particular sectors. So we're a lot better these days. It's a lot less random than it maybe used to be in terms of how we actually target particularly our enforcement resources. So we might find a big problem with some sort of particular type of marketing or some particular type of business. Prime investigators are an obvious example. And then we target those particular high-risk groups. So, I mean, we're never going to be positioned to sort of check everything, but we can use the resources we've got in the most sensible way, which I think is about the best we can do, and take some high-profile cases, publicise them well.
Yeah.
Do a lot of things like this, so you talking to your customers, you know, via your company, and we do a lot of outreach where we do a lot of public talking. So, I mean, we do try and get the message across that there are rules here, to explain what they are, and that they're not actually that bad. They're actually quite good for you as a business if you approach them in the right spirit.
Right. And, you know, if you feel like you've been taken advantage of, you can flag it up. You know, are people going to be kind of confident that things are going to get looked at? Is there going to be...
Yeah, they are, and what we can't do, I mean, we used to investigate every single complaint we got. When I started the ICO, it was a long time ago. We were dealing with probably a few hundred complaints a year, a lot fewer staff, obviously, but we could kind of look at them all individually and better, but we can't really do that anymore. So we sort of group them and analyse them and look for tendencies and trends, and that's how we decide what to do.
Right.
But in terms of members of the public and concerns they've got, I mean, they can ring us up at any time. All the information's on our website, which is www.ico.org.uk. It's all on there. You can make written complaints. There's a complaint form there. You can actually talk to somebody in real time. We'll give you advice. And that goes for, you know, people running businesses as well.
Mm.
And we're keen to help SMEs in particular.
Yeah.
So we've got a range of services, and I hope that people understand that whilst we might not be able to look at every complaint individually, we do get the intelligence from that, and ultimately that feeds into the process.
Yeah. Well, I almost actually think that it's a slightly better way of doing things than kind of taking each individual on a case-by-case basis. If you're grouping them together, you see trends. Well, I mean, you know, people get pissed off, don't they, and they want to, you know, whatever. Absolutely. So I, you know, unnecessarily so, and so I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, do you think there's still like that push to try and get some more government funding to help out with kind of the task at hand, or is that kind of always an uphill battle?
It's always going to be an uphill battle, but I think there is a strong case, given the breadth of our responsibilities and given the GDPR, that we could do with some more staff.
Yeah.
To deal with this. But what you say about analysing complaints is right. A good example is subject access, where, say, some police forces are really bad at giving people access to their records. So instead of like pursuing each complaint individually, we pursue the organisation and we put it on sort of special measures, essentially. So we monitor their performance and we go and check them and do audits, that kind of thing. And gradually it means people do get their records on time. So it can be maybe frustrating on a personal level for the actual applicant, but in the longer term, we just got to use public money in the most effective way, and that's the best way of doing it.
Right.
And when we talk about kind of the cyber attacks, is all those kind of things fed into what is now become GDPR? Was it the Data Protection Act of 98? Was it?
Yeah.
So what kind of has kind of spurred on to, for it to be now GDPR? Where's that kind of push come from? What changes have kind of what are the kind of the, I suppose the key differences from the Data Protection Act of 98?
Yeah. Well, the reason it all came about was there was a general feeling that the current data protection law, which was being drafted in the mid-90s, was very old. It was done at a time before most companies were even using the internet. It was done at a time before social media. No one had heard of Facebook. So there was a general feeling it had to be updated. I guess the main changes are, well, focus a bit on the continuity. I mean, it's based on the same sort of principles, the same sort of basic concept. It's meant to do the same sort of things. It's got broadly the same kinds of individual rights in it, broadly the same responsibilities for organisations. So that part of it is all fairly much business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly for bigger, very information-intensive businesses, there are some new things. There's a much more emphasis on what they call accountability, which is having a kind of demonstrable compliance system in place. So you need to have the kind of procedures there, the documentation to show how you are complying with the law. That's new. There are some new rights for people. There's a thing called data portability, which is when you as a member of the public write to, say, your electricity company or your mobile phone provider, and you've got a right to get your data in a machine-readable form. And if you want, you can have it transferred directly from, say, Vodafone to British Telecom directly, so that they can, check tariffs and all that kind of stuff, which is good from a kind of consumer protection, competition kind of point of view.
Mm.
So there are some new things in there. There's quite a complicated consistency mechanism, which is new, which is meant to bring about the same or similar data protection standards across the European Union. That's new, although we've worked with other data protection authorities for decades, so that sense it's not new. But those are the main things, really. And I think generally it's more detailed in terms of what you have to do, what you're not allowed to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a bigger fines regime. So at the moment, across Europe, the different data protection authorities have different fining powers. Some can't fine anything at all.
Mm.
And we can fine up to £500,000. Under the GDPR, it'd be a lot higher than that, or it could be a lot higher than that. So they're up the ante in terms of what happens if you deliberately do something wrong, basically.
Right. A lot of people, we did have a few people ask who wanted to kind of get some clarity on some questions. So I think a lot of the stuff is about kind of the length of time and how you can hold on to personal information. I know that, and I suppose we're looking for clarity on this, that there was various times that you're allotted to maintain and hold people's personal information on a CRM or a database, for example. Yeah. What new regulations are coming in around that?
The rules are basically the same, but in terms of all the information that people keep, there aren't that many cases where there is a set rule. Right, there's some rules to do with hospital records, to do with police records, banking records. And there are obvious like triggers for how long you should keep things. For example, the amount of time you can dispute a transaction of some sort might be X number of years. So obviously, if there's a strong case for keeping the records for that amount of time. But often in all sorts of other contexts, for example, like you say, customer relation management databases and employee records, there aren't any really clear set rules. So what you've got to do is just go through a different kind of process and say, well, look, why do I need to keep this record? What's the chance of it being challenged in some way? What's the chance of someone asking for access to it? And if you've got a load of records that have been there for years and years, no one's ever looked at them, no one's ever used them for anything, no one's ever asked to see them, then there's a good case that they should be got rid of.
So what would be a bad an example of someone doing that incorrectly, holding on to information for too long? For what reason? What would constitute, you know, a breach?
It's really people. It's often easier to keep hold of stuff than to delete it because storage gets cheaper and so forth. But the problem really is that what you've got to do really is periodically assess what you've got. What records do you keep about people, your employees, your customers, whoever it is, and say, do I need this anymore? And if you don't need it, you should get rid of it. I mean, that's pretty much what the rule says.
Right.
And that requires judgment, and it requires some sort of technical ability to, A, to know what records you've got in the first place, and then the sort of technical ability to get rid of them. But you shouldn't be scared of getting rid of records if you've not got a duty to keep them. And there are some records where you have. Health records is an obvious example, then you are pretty free really to keep them or delete them according to business need.
Right, okay.
So no one's going to come to you and, you know, a customer in 10 years who you dealt with years and years ago and say, oh, can I, you know, you've not got my records anymore, I'm going to complain to the ICO. We just say, well, we've deleted them in accordance with the law and that's fine.
Yeah.
You've got, again, it's about reasonableness more than anything.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily, it's not like, There is a set period of time you can only maintain people's records for a certain amount of time. There's no kind of hard guidelines.
No, there isn't. It's more about...
Because, you know, that's been the big rumours that we've heard.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's more about review. I mean, one thing you could do, I mean, we're very keen on the industry developing its own standards. So if there is a particular sector or a particular employer's group and they want to sort of set some sort of standards for how long it's reasonable to keep employee records, for example, then we'd welcome that and we'd use their rules in our own kind of enforcement activities. But there's a whole lot of things in the world generally, and in data protection particularly, you just got to look at the circumstances and make a reasonable call. And we're reasonable regulators, and if you retain information because people ask to see it or it's got some sort of value or you use it for something, then, you know, fine.
It's just keeping it for now.
Lying around, then why?
Yeah.
It's just a liability.
Right, okay. That makes sense. And that, I think that clears up that question. So I'm just going to read this one out. So someone says, one thing that interests me is how will companies manage employment references moving forward? If they are required to delete past employee personal data from their systems under GDPR, does other legislations potentially have a bearing on this? Are company duties bound to keep past employee details on record for particular periods of time, for example?
There's no like set record, but what you ought to do is try and find if there's any sort of industry good practice from employers groups, CIPD or something like that. And that's quite weighty in terms of what, you know, how we as a regulator approach things. But the point is, if you've got an employee and they worked for you 10 years ago or whatever it is, 15 years ago or 5 years ago, you've had no contact with them, you're under no duty to keep the record, and they come back to you and say, can I have a reference, please? And you say, sorry, no, I've not got the records anymore. So be it.
Yeah. And I, finally as well, I think when you know you open up cases, what's the perfect kind of case where, you know, you clamped down, you stopped some bad behaviours happening, and that was like, excellent, we feel good about kind of doing our job there, that's really helped X, Y, Z. Like, what would be kind of the prime example of, you know, why you guys, you know, exist, what the importance is of it, and kind of things around that?
There's a couple of things, right, at either end of the spectrum, really. Remember when I started at the ICO, one of the most satisfying things, I started doing complaints about health records and policy stuff in the health service. And sometimes you got really kind of snotty, dismissive consultants who really didn't want to give poor little patients their records. So they just thought it was a complete waste of time, they had no rights. And to actually make them do it was very satisfying that some little old man or little old lady got the records. That was very good. And you also get some bigger wins. I mean, I don't know if you read recently about all the Google DeepMind stuff in the health service, where basically a health service body was partnering with Google to develop this app, which was to monitor some health condition. And that, we heard about this, and there were complaints and so forth. And as a result of that, I think we've done some very useful stuff on how health service bodies should partner with tech companies. They're going to do this. It's not, you know, they're not going to develop tech within the health service. The partnerships are going to happen, but what the rules are in terms of how you explain this to patients, how you test things, whether you use live data, how much live data, all those sorts of things got aired. And it means that in the future, when these things happen, we'll have learned and we'll do things better in the future. And that's what we're trying to do, really.
Right. Yeah. I think it's just, so it's really about kind of, there is business cases as well, where people are kind of taking advantage of people for financial gain or whatever.
Yeah.
Which, so that's kind of the main driver, I suppose. But it's also giving people the right to the data that other people are collecting on their behalf to have the access to that.
Getting access to records and getting, even after all these years, I think some organisations still don't realise that people have got a legal right of access. And it's limited in some cases, but not very much.
Right.
And we just got to get that common sense through to organisations that, yeah, people have got a right. And there are implications of that in terms of how you record things, in terms of accuracy, because you can be fairly sure that when somebody, not always, but often when somebody asks for their records, it's got to be some sort of dispute, typically ex-employees, patients who think they've been treated badly, people who think their police records are inaccurate, all those sorts of things. So the subject's access thing is important because it drives improvement in the way people record things. And going back again to when I started doing health record stuff, some of the things that doctors used to write on medical records, you wouldn't believe, you know, and they wouldn't do that now because they know patients have got a right of access and it's probably going to come out. And it generally drives improvement, and it's a gradual process, and we're on the road, you know.
And I suppose my final question, just to get some clarity on this, is the way people are kind of gathering data now, you know, there's obviously, I think, a hard line on that side of things, as well as much as people, the way people are actually using and interpreting data. But I suppose, is it as big of a deal how they're actually gathering the data, where they're pulling it from?
Yeah.
So if you're actively going out seeking people's email addresses, phone numbers, whatever, and you're getting it from wherever, using a tool online to pull that kind of stuff, is that really where, you know, are you focusing as much that, or is it more about kind of what they go on to do with that information?
Yeah, I think the initial collection is important, and it's a complicated issue, but the fact that you put something on the internet doesn't mean it's fair game. There are still limits in terms of what you can do with it, in terms of the fair use of that information, the reasonable use, lawful use of it. So those things remain in there. And I think sometimes people do think that just because they're seeing something on the internet, they can use it for any purpose. In reality, it might be difficult to stop them, but there are still rules in place, so that's important. And it's true that people are collecting more stuff in more clever ways, often ways you don't know about. And I think there's a real issue in terms of how we engage particular technology companies over how this occurs and how we get that message across that, okay, you may be able to do all sorts of terribly clever things, but that doesn't mean you should do them or you can do them. There's still that basic relationship between you and that individual, which has to be an ethical and a reasonable one. And that's, like I've said throughout this conversation, what this is all about, really.
So is that something that you're policing quite heavily then on that side, or is it, again, is it just based on what people are kind of, you know, flagging up, I suppose?
No, we do both. We both, as we said before, get intelligence from people's complaints, but we also engage one-to-one with big players in the industry and with trade bodies. We do a lot of stuff with the Internet Advertising Bureau, for example, to try and put industry standards in place, which has actually worked very well. So we're fighting a number of fronts, but we are aware of the creepy line we talked about earlier and that there are ways of mitigating that.
Right. Well, thanks, Ian.
Pleasure.
Pleasure, mate.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website venturi-group.com and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news and podcasts. Or drop me a line, it's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.